Welcome back, faithful listeners, to part two of Two Guys Won't Work in the Cinemas. Our year in blockbusters, 2005? 2005. We've gone right the way back into 2015.
Oh, I've written notes for modern films. Whoops.
You know, 2000. I fucking love 2005. That was a great year.
I can't remember a single film.
It was one of my best years. Anyway,
well, name some films that came out.
I can't remember film-wise. I just remember meeting George Romero for the first time. Well, for the first time, as if now we're firm friends.
I can't remember anything from any specific year.
And talking about firm friends, the reason this particular podcast episode, well, these two episodes exist, is because you came to visit Edinburgh, didn't you? And you met our fans.
Yeah, I came up for your 30th birthday shindig, and I bumped into some people. That was a surreal experience. You going, these people acting like, oh, it's Stuart, and I'm like, this is a wind up. Mark's like an elaborate wind up. He's like, oh, act like you're really excited to meet him. He'll get a kick out of it. It's a bit, and they're like, Mark, I don't want to do that. The guy's a prick. Don't like him. And it's like, no, just do it. It'll be funny. But it's surreal.
The best bit, though, was when I was, I think you were in the corner talking to Jason. And I went, sure, there's a guy over there who really wants to speak to you. And you were like, oh, no, he doesn't. No, you're just winding me up. I was like, no, seriously. And I looked around, and that exact moment, Tom stood up and went, is that Stuart from Two Guys Don't Work in the Cinema? And I had swear to you, I had not prompted him to do that.
Is that the closest I'll ever get to feeling famous, I think?
Oh, well. No, come on, you know, you're Dark Souls. I almost called it Dead Souls there. That's a... your Dark Souls video on the YouTube.
Yeah, but I'm just Thin Reaper to all these anonymous... Nah. I don't want the fucking strangers of the internet knowing who I am.
Knowing your name and
just
where you live.
Random people, yeah. No, your friends are really nice, though. All really, really lovely people.
But you've got an apology to make, haven't you?
Well, it's a long, complicated story. Nikita and Jamie were... Because this is what happened. Towards the end of the night, we'd gone to for your 30th birthday at a little bar. We were having a lovely time. But I had a raging headache. And me and Amy, my girlfriend, we kind of run out of money. We were both really tired. We didn't want to spend too much more. And I said to Amy, like, do you want to, like, everyone's going to this club. And I was like, do you want to just head back to the hotel? And she's like, yeah, I want to go home. I'm really tired. And I went, okay, cool. I'll tell Mark. And I told you were fine about it. And Nikita was like, oh, no, why are you going home? Come out. And I was just like, oh, I've got a really bad headache. She's like, take some paracetamol. I'm like, no, it's okay. We haven't got much money. She's like, I'll buy you a drink. I was like, you're making it really difficult to say that.
She's like, the nicest person I've ever met. And when she gets drunk, she's even nicer. It's a nightmare.
And then this is the best bit. I went, oh no, so we're both really tired. We just need to go home and sleep. And Amy comes up to me and goes, I'm not tired. It's him that wants to go home. I'm still up for going out. I was like, fucking cunt, she just betrayed me, sold me out, made me look like an absolute, just 2 minutes ago, gone, yeah, I'm really tired, I want to go home. So I'm like going up there going, yeah, we're really tired. So I'm not tired, it's you. I'm like, you fucking prick. I was like, well, guess we're going to the club then, because she just talked us into it. But anyway, so like we go to the club, and I thought, oh, it's fine, I'll suck it up, it's Mark's 30th birthday. I was having a good time. We got to this club, and when we got to the bit inside, they were like, it was like £8 to get in or something. Like, fucking get out of there.
It was not worth the £8, I can tell you.
I was like, it's £8 to get in, it's fucking go. And we just went. And I felt really horrible afterwards because Nikita was so friendly. So I really wanted him to come out. And I was having a good time. They're really lovely, your friends. But I was just, £8, fuck off. Just gone. I felt so rude because I didn't say goodbye after that.
I'm sure you'll see them again.
I hope so, just so I can apologise in person.
But in this hour, what are we going to be discussing? We're going to be discussing The Martian.
Yeah, The Martian.
Spectre. And Star Wars, as I'm sure you're all really excited to hear what we both thought of Star Wars Episode 7, The Force Awakens.
I'm excited to talk about it.
Yeah, yeah. But, you know, new Star Wars film. Will it be praised to Cloud City or will it be Darth Mauled? Who knows? We'll find out later on.
Oh my god, that's...
It's better than your one from earlier, come on.
Well, fair enough. Well, you're going to cut my one out, so I'm going to have to cut that out. Otherwise, it won't make any sense. I'm going to have to leave it in now. Well done, Mark. Right, fucking Martian. That bloke stuck on that planet.
Ridley Scott's return to form.
No. It's what I keep hearing.
No.
This is the thing. I enjoyed The Martian. It was a fine film. But a return to form. It had a good script, good characters, a good premise, good actors, and it was based on good source material. Literally all Ridley Scott had to do to not fuck it up was make it look nice. And that is literally all Ridley Scott can do. So I don't... I'd need to see a lot more.
Yeah, I think that's maybe a fair point.
For it to be, it's his return to form. No, not really. It was like basically a free pass. I mean, there's not actually. I'm assuming a lot of it was done green screen. A lot of Mars, or maybe they shot on Earth, but you know, did a bit of
color correction and stuff like that. Yeah.
Yeah, but I mean, it looks stunning just because you know that the vistas look quite stunning.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure it was even that amazingly shot. Do you know what I mean? It's not like Gravity. It was just kind of, but you know,
yeah,
credit where credit's due. Ridley Scott can make a good looking film. I just don't think, I feel like you could have got 10 different filmmakers that would have done just as good a job as Ridley Scott has done.
I mean, it is really the script and the performances that are really the sort of stars of the show.
Yeah.
I mean, yes, it is visually impressive and, you know, it looks great. But, I mean, at the end of the day, it's a guy stuck by himself. And it's the people back on Earth trying to get him home. That, you know, that a lot of that relies on good dialogue and good performances, which you have. You've got some. Matt Damon's great. Jeff Daniels is really good in it, I think. I really enjoyed it. I was really surprised by how much I enjoyed it, actually. Because I didn't really know anything about the book.
No, I didn't know anything about it. I'd never heard it. I didn't know it was a book until the film came out and everyone started going on about this great book that it's based on.
Mm-hmm. So I just kind of went along and I just really enjoyed it. Just like got really kind of swept along in the story. And it was funny. There's some really good jokes in it.
Yeah.
And it's kind of clever. I think there's some actual proper science and engineering in it as well. So like I felt I was learning something, although I've not retained any of that knowledge. So I hope I don't get stuck on Mars, because that would be...
Oh, no, if I got stuck on Mars, I'd be fine.
Yeah?
I'm quite confident. Send me there. I'd be fine.
You just take a shit on the floor and then put a potato in it. You go, right, that's fine.
I'm like, take a shit. And I'm like, that's going to turn into a plant later. I'll come back to that.
Okay, if I remember this Ridley Scott film correctly, if I take a shit on this floor... My problems will be solved unless there's a catastrophic storm which will destroy my potato crops.
No, I thought it was fine. I have no criticisms of it, but then I haven't really got anything amazing to say about it. I didn't see any mark of truly great filmmaking in it.
I don't know. I mean, I wouldn't necessarily say it was a great film.
It was really enjoyable. You know, yeah, it was fun. It was funny. It was well written.
Yeah. And I think that's the reason.
It was kind of snappy and interesting because it was about science. Like you say,
mm-hmm.
You felt like, I'm like kind of learning stuff. It's about something you don't know, but it makes really complex science accessible to a complete non-science person. Mm-hmm. And that's so it's interesting. It's got good stakes, I guess, as a guy's, you know, going to die on a planet. It's well paced as well, I guess. Like it for a film about someone just stuck on their own for years, it's not, you know, boring.
No,
so it's well paced. It's got a good rhythm to it. You know, it's fine. It's just perfectly fine film.
Yeah, it is. It is. I mean, but I think the thing is, I mean, you know, we're both guilty of this kind of, you know, analysing films and stuff like that. And I think, at the end of the day, a lot of the time, the reason people go to the cinema is to be entertained and to be taken on an enjoyable journey and to, you know. And I think The Martian really succeeds in that. It's just a good, solid piece of entertainment.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think actually a bit like what I thought about Mad Max is it's not pretentious. There's nothing pretentious about it. It doesn't have any lofty ambitions.
No.
About it. It is what it is. And it does what it does really, really well. I don't see how you could make it better. Do you know what I mean?
No,
I don't think,
no.
Oh yeah, if they'd done this, it would have been much, much better. I think, you know, I don't see how you could have made that film, you know, any more efficiently, if you like. It was just a really enjoyable piece of entertainment, but kind of like throwaway. It's not the kind of like really lasting. It's not going to have a really lasting impact on anyone, I don't think.
No. I mean, it's not, you know, on anybody's sort of film of the year list or anything like that. But as like I say, as a piece of entertainment, I really, really enjoyed it. And yeah, it looks nice. It's got some great dialogue. It's funny. It's exciting. There's a good use of disco music, which I'm a sucker for incongruous music with action sequences. I love stuff like that. Because I heard a criticism that people were like, "Oh yeah, but when he started playing ABBA, you knew he wasn't going to die, so it kind of reduced any risk." I was like, "No."
What?
I just thought it was really funny that they were playing ABBA as he's trying, like Waterloo, as he's trying to escape. You know, that's just, it's just a good gag.
Why would ABBA mean you're not going to die?
Well, because it's like a lighter, it's the lightness of touch. You know, the music's a bit frothy, so you wouldn't play that over some sort of catastrophic event. It's like, well, no, sometimes that works really well. Sometimes that highlights the fucking tragedy if you've got this kind of.
Or they fucking die and you fade the ABBA out and bring in some sad music at the same time.
And you'd be like, oh God, be punched in the stomach. But thank God he didn't die and he went off to.
No. I mean, I didn't expect for a minute he was going to die.
No, of course not.
Not that kind of film. Like from the first 10 minutes or whatever, you're like, he's not going to die. Yeah. It's about him getting rescued.
He survived getting blown off a cliff. If he survived that, he's gonna get off Mars just fine. Don't you worry.
Yeah.
It's good, wasn't it? It's good.
Right, Spectre. A not so perfect film.
No, not perfect. I've heard some people. I mean, I know you didn't enjoy it.
Well, I went to see it, and I was like, It came out in the UK quite a while before it came out in the US, didn't it?
Yes,
and
it
I went
did,
to see
yeah.
it and was like, oh, I had a lot of problems.
Well, rightly so, Stuart. Rightly so. It's James Bond. it's the thing that funds our fucking British film industry. That and tax breaks for big Hollywood studios to film in the UK. But that's,
I had a lot of problems with it, but it was getting like unanimously positive reviews. But
well,
then it came out in America.
Wasn't.
Well, it came out in America, they did not like it. And not just America, but a lot of the other market. And they were a lot more harsh on it, I think,
and I think
than
when
even
people,
I was.
When people had seen it as well, I mean, you're right, the newspaper reviews and film magazines and stuff like that were all pretty much overwhelmingly positive about it.
What did Kermode give it? What did Kermode
really
it?
Liked it.
There you go.
Kermode liked it. Peter Bradshaw and The Guardian liked it. He put it as one of his favourite films of the year, which I was like, all right, steady on, Bradshaw. Steady on. But when the actual cinema going public went to see it, like my mum's boyfriend, I think he's quite a good example of sort of man on the street. He loves his action films. He loves his James Bond, and he went to see it. It was just boring. Like it was just really kind of navel gazing, and there was like some good action sequences, but then there was just like loads of just, it's too long. And I do kind of agree. I do think it was too long.
I think it. I think certain aspects could have been cut. I thought the car chase was a bit long. I thought Monica...
That was a mistake.
Is it Monica Lewinsky?
Monica Bellucci. Monica Lewinsky.
I can't remember which one had an affair with Bill Clinton. I get their names mixed up. I thought I didn't really see what relevance she had.
And it was really rapey as well.
It was well rapey.
It's like James Bond breaks into her house, fills her up a bit, and says, "I know your husband's just died, but I've broken into your house and I've got nowhere else to go." It's a bit. It was that kind of old school James Bond thing which you can't really get away with now. You know, that kind of Sean Connery slapping a woman on the arse or punching a woman in the face, or, you know, Roger Moore kind of forcing himself on a young... Yeah, it's not on in this day and age.
But if I pin her down and force a kiss on her...
Yeah, she'll fall in love with me.
She'll realise she's into it and, like, give in.
Yeah.
I think whether you like it or not depends on what your preferences are with James Bond as a series.
Yeah.
A lot of people have been really pining for that. Like, I miss the old, like, it was a bit more fun and cheesy and a bit more camp. Mm-hmm. Some people miss that kind of James Bond.
I do.
And other people really like, this would be me, the more serious tone that it's taken and wants to see it taken in that direction. And I remember saying Skyfall, I think, was like one step, or wondering if Skyfall would be like two steps forward, one step back. And this really felt like a step backwards in a lot of ways. Like, for me, it was too cheesy, too camp. There were scenes in it, ridiculous set pieces, like the whole thing with MI6 at the end, like, oh, you can escape the building or you can rescue the girl. And I was like, this doesn't belong in this film. Like, the series, the way the reboot has been taken, this feels completely out of place. It feels really regressive.
It seems like a Sam Mendes choice to always bring the action back to the UK. Because, I mean, that's what happens in Skyfall. They come back to Britain. Well, actually, most of Skyfall takes place in the UK.
It doesn't really leave much, does it? China, Shanghai, is it? For a bit?
Yeah, there's a bit in Shanghai. And then, is that where he meets Javier Bardem? In that island.
That island. Yeah. And then he's back in London. Island's... Yeah.
And I just... That's never been why we watch James Bond films. You know, it's always been that escapism, that kind of, you know, exotic locations and...
Yeah.
And I think, and as much as I like Skyfall, and I think as a brilliant image it is to see James Bond getting on the tube, you've done that in Skyfall. You don't need to do the exact same thing again with Spectre and bring it back to the UK and for, like, the big climax. I don't know. But, I have to say... I went to see it with my dad, and I just... Because my dad's recently retired, so I've kind of decided... I've very much made the effort to take him to the cinema with me now when I go and see stuff. But it's all, like, dad films. It's all, like, you know, James Bond. We went to see Bridge of Spies together. I can't remember the other... Took him to see Sicario as well, the Dennis...
I really wanted to see both of those films. Were they good?
Yes. Yes, they were.
Great.
We'll maybe talk at the end about other sort of stuff that we've seen this year. But
games, and that's it. That's it. But, I don't really care about talking about it.
But I was sitting there watching Spectre with my dad, and I was just like, "Do you know what? This is fun. It is. I'm enjoying this. This is kind of the James Bond that I like. I know you prefer the more serious tone, but I kind of like the action set pieces, the smarmy dialogue, the henchmen and this sort of villainous cabal and all that kind of thing. I like it. But then, about the moment in which Bond's being captured by Christoph Waltz's character, and he's trussed up and he's being tortured, and then he wakes up and Christoph Waltz's character holds a white cat, I almost walked out of the cinema.
Yeah, that honestly, for me, like, I didn't have a problem with a lot of the stuff. It was that bit where the whole thing started to really go off the fucking rails.
Yeah, because the thing is, I think the idea of a James Bond film which tries to talk about surveillance technology and and drones and all that kind of stuff, fine, great, perfect. I think, you know,
yeah,
it's good that, because James Bond is, you know, one of our great, you know, as a country, is one of our great sort of fictional characters. He's up there with, you know, Doctor Who. He's up there with, you know, in terms of exports. And so obviously, like, I think these characters should talk about things that affect the society in which they reflect. So that was all fine. And I'm like, okay, right, I'm really into this. This is really good. And then the Blofeld reveal, I was just like, it was just like Star Trek Into Darkness all over again.
Yeah, I've got that written down. Like, it's that same sort of, like, if you know anything about the series, you know it's Blofeld before you've even sat down in the cinema. Yeah. So that it has no impact.
Yeah.
And if you don't know anything about the series, you don't know who Blofeld is, and it has no impact. So it's mm-hmm. just like, what's the point?
Yeah.
What's the point?
And the
create,
thing
your
is,
own, create your own fucking villain. New villains that are
and
memorable.
And Christoph Waltz is such a... And much like... I mean, I kind of have a love-hate relationship with Benedict Cumberbatch, but much like Benedict Cumberbatch, I think Christoph Waltz was born to play a Bond villain, you know.
Yeah.
And it's a kind of a shame that they kind of fudged it.
Well, that's the other thing. It's not just that, oh, the reveal of Blofeld's a bit, like, misguided. It's just that as a character, he's barely in it. It's not really underused.
And also, he's not really the main
rubbish.
Villain. It's kind of more Andrew Schofield. Is it Andrew Schofield? Yeah, Andrew Schofield, who plays C. in it. You know, he seems to be the main villain because he's actually the one that's threatening MI6, and that's kind of what it all becomes about, is to preserve that kind of old way of doing things, the old-fashioned James Bond way of doing things.
Yeah.
And it's just a bit of a mess.
And then it doesn't even, like, set up for, like, oh, God, shit, Blofeld's revealed. Like, what's he going to... He's captured at the end. Yeah. So what the fuck? He's, like, he's in it. It's, oh, shit, Blofeld. It's a couple of ridiculous over-the-top bits. So as soon as you realise it's Blofeld, he starts doing really over-the-top stuff, like, you know, rigging an entire national security building with explosives and tying someone up in, like, a Spider-Man web or something. I can't remember.
Yeah.
Does he do that? Is there someone... Or is he just... No, he jumps down, doesn't he? He jumps down
thing,
into... He jumps down into, like, a fucking thing. Oh, whatever, I can't remember. He does all of that. It's just over the top. And then Bond, he just tries to fly away in his shop, and Bond's like, poof, poof, puts him down, makes him look like a dick. It's just really just, like, undermined the character in a way for me. I just thought it was just they botched the villain.
Yeah, I mean, the thing is, I'm not one of
these... It's Bond's biggest villain. It's
exactly.
Like Dr. Evil.
Yeah.
In the whole Austin Powers is about Bond and Blofeld.
Yeah.
It's like, it's the quintessential Bond villain, and they completely botched him.
I don't have an issue with redoing that character if you're going to do it in the proper way, but they just don't. Because they try to keep it a secret, you know, to kind of just drum up a bit of speculation and marketing and all that kind of thing. Rather than just kind of go, oh, so we're redoing this character. You know, because it works for Doctor Who, right? Whenever they bring back an old monster, they pretty much announce it going, oh, we're reimagining this old monster. And that's the marketing. That's what gets people into watching, because they go, oh, they're bringing that back. That's exciting.
Yeah.
Why not do that with James Bond? Why not do that with Star Trek? Why not go, right, we're bringing back Blofeld? That would have been a huge thing.
But you're right. Everyone knew, like, if you're into Bond, the film's called Spectre.
Yeah.
And Christoph Waltz is dressed in a similar sort of outfit.
Yeah, the Nehru jacket, I think they call
he's
it.
He's at the table, sort of shrouded in darkness, like, kind of unseen. It was obviously going to be Blofeld. It wasn't a surprise.
But that's the thing, so why not, like, go hell for leather in the script?
Exactly, yeah. I don't understand
and this
why they tried to
thing
make
about
it this big reveal
were,
in the script.
They were brothers and all that. Well, not biological brothers, but foster
yeah,
and all
tough.
That nonsense.
I forgot about that. What a load of bollocks.
Yeah.
Why do that?
And it's just, it was just a bit of a mess. But up until that point, I was really enjoying it.
I thought, you know, it looks good. It's not as beautiful to look at as Skyfall. It doesn't have I don't think it's as impressive cinematography-wise. Because there's bits in Skyfall, like in Scotland, and particularly that fight in the dark.
In the house.
With all the lights behind it. Yeah, in Shanghai or wherever it is.
Oh, right, yeah.
That looks amazing. But, yeah, it looks good. It's got nice locations. It's got a good script.
Well, it opens with an incredible, you know, that kind of one tracking shot that it opens with, which is something you've not ever really seen in Bond before. That's really cool.
Yeah, that was cool. And I thought Daniel Craig was his best performance as Bond.
Definitely.
Yeah,
definitely.
I thought he was the most comfortable, the most confident in the role as he's been. And I thought he was brilliant. There's moments like where he punches that security guard or something.
Oh, yeah.
And when he gets to get up, he's like, no, or don't, or something. And I thought that was brilliant. Like, I laughed out loud. I thought, that's great. So there's some really some good stuff I like in it. I really like the henchman. I thought, yeah, it's good that that's that homage to the old series,
Batista,
having a memorable henchman.
Yeah.
And I thought he was a good henchman, and the fights were pretty good. That fight with him on the train was
really cool. It's a really lovely homage to From Russia With Love, that kind of, you know...
I felt like there was a lot of homages to the older films all throughout, like all the different the series. It felt like there was a lot of.
It's funny because it feels more. I mean, as much as Skyfall was like the 50th anniversary of James Bond,
this felt more like a
tribute.
This
feels more like a tribute than Skyfall did.
Because there was a lot of On Her Majesty's Secret Service,
type all the snow
in
stuff
there as well.
The sort of mysterious sort of treatment center at the top of the Alps and all that kind of thing.
Yeah, and I even liked something that I've seen a lot of people criticise, was that at the end, where it's kind of like you realise that Blofeld's behind the previous three films' villains, or like the orchestrator of everything. I kind of liked how it tied those things together, because
I always
thought that those things, they were all kind of lacking. Like, Quantum was always a poor man's Spectre, so it was good that actually you find it's a kind of... subsidiary of Spectre. Like, Quantum's an organisation that belongs to Spectre.
Mm-hmm.
I liked that. And I always thought Silver, is that the guy's name from Skyfall, the villain?
Yeah, De Silva. Javier
Bardem. His whole fucking scheme was just really crap. Like, I hate M. I've got mummy issues. I hate M. And he does all this ridiculous over-the-top stuff just because he doesn't like M. Tying that in with Spectre, and actually you can then start to imagine that Blofeld has a reason to do all that stuff, and gave Silver permission to, knowing that he was a bit mental, might have exploited his nature, and told him to commit all these terrorist atrocities to further his own agenda to do with, you know, like privatising national security and all of that stuff, and gaining more control over Britain's national security. So the idea that actually that Blofeld might have been the one that pushed and manipulated Silver into doing all that stuff was, I actually think, retroactively makes Skyfall make a lot more sense. Because that whole, I always hated Silver's, you know, motivation for doing all the stuff that he did in that film. I thought it was a massive weakness to do Skyfall. So those are the things I really liked about it. But the biggest, hands down, standout problem for me was the romance in
Spectre.
Yeah. They just absolutely shit the bed again. Because I thought they fucked it up in Casino Royale. And it's a big Bond reboot. And in the first film, he falls in love and quits. When he's all in the first film, I never liked that. And then he's quit again. It's like every time he falls in love with some floozy, he fucking jacks the job in. And the next film, she's probably going to get killed. If it's anything like on Her Majesty's Secret Service, she's going to get fucking killed. And he'll come back like, oh, I have my job back. Yeah, it's like, I'd be like, no, don't worry about it. Because you've gone rogue on every single mission we've given you. You've fucking gone rogue. Sick of you. Sick of the paperwork, Bond. Go. Go home. It's ridiculous. It just undermines the character. I don't want to see Bond keep quitting his job every time he falls in love. And falling in love really easily, it was a massive cock-up. I feel like if they'd had any kind of foresight whatsoever, they would have saved that story from Casino Royale with Vespa and just kind of merged it with this one. I actually think the one in Spectre, the storyline in Spectre would really, really work well if it hadn't have already happened in Casino Royale.
I don't know if I really bought into it more than any other time when James Bond is teamed up with a woman and they have sex with each other.
And they fall in love.
Yeah. And then by the end of the film, it's just like, okay.
Because that's the thing. I hate being told that someone's falling in love. I want to see people fall in love. I want to see like a fucking
connection. Really, if you were to take that quote out of context, that would be a really lovely, heartfelt statement from you. I like to see people falling in love. Stuart Flint, 2016.
Wait, no, but On Her Majesty's Secret Service, which had a climax that fucking entirely hinged on the idea that you believe Bond has fallen in love, mm-hmm. it goes out of its way to show you a montage of them spending time with each other and falling in love. You've got that brilliant...
the Louis Armstrong song. Yeah,
that's it, Louis Armstrong. And you've got that beautiful song and a montage of them spending time with each other. Before that, they have a kind of chemistry with each other. You see them interacting. So you see Bond falling in love with Diana Rigg's character, Teresa, isn't it? So that works. And they just... They think the Inspector, which is kind of, you know, in that respect, a remake, they just completely skip it. I don't need to show it. Just tell the audience they're falling in love. Oh, it's so fucking insulting. It makes me so fucking angry, Mark, because it's how many decades of filmmaking have we been through? You'd think that there are certain fucking boxes you need to tick. If you're doing a script, it involves a love. Right, make sure you show them falling in love. Don't just tell the audience. So it should be like basic writing 101. How, in 2015, are we still writing films with, you know, romance being this major plot point and it being fucking botched like that? It blows my mind and it really makes me angry when it's something like fucking Spectre. You know what? Bond, which is one of the biggest franchises in the movie industry. Yeah. I don't understand how that shit passes.
But then James Bond's never really, as a franchise, has never really been known for its kind of realistic portrayals of human relationships. On Her Majesty's Secret Service aside.
But that's the thing with the reboot. I am always... This is my problem with the reboots. Every film I've watched, I expect more and I want more. And then after a year or so, I kind of make my peace with it's a fucking action film. And it's I wish they would take them more seriously. As good as Skyfall was, I felt like, oh, it's got Sam Mendes doing it and he's taking it really seriously. It looks really good and it's, you know, it's got like better performances and a better script. It's still like... It doesn't have anything like meaningful in it. Do you know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
I'd love to see a Bond film that could genuinely like be a contender for like an Oscar or something, like be nominated for an Oscar because it does something really interesting. I'd like to see a Bond film. No, I don't see why. I don't see why a Bond film can do something as well as Captain America: Winter Soldier did,
nominated for an Oscar either. Let's be honest.
No, but. It could. I don't think anyone would have been throwing their arms up in the air if it had been. I'm not saying it should win an Oscar, but like just to be nominated. Maybe Winter Soldier wasn't Oscar material, but you get what I mean. It was like it was a good.
It was doing something interesting.
And it had like a really like meaningful idea at its core, and it explored interesting ideas. And it was like genuinely like high stakes and it really understood its character. Because, you know, the idea of it, you know, like fascism in the modern world or a kind of hidden fascism was actually everything that a really like personification of the American hero was. Everything he stood against. Definitely. And that was modern America. That is a really brilliant understanding of what Captain America is and subverting that for a modern audience. I'd love to see a Bond film do something interesting like that. And it always fucking gets really close to it. We're talking about like governments trying to... corporations trying to sort of destabilise third world governments for oil and, you know... There's lines of dialogue in the Bond films. We're not the good guys anymore. It's all about oil. We need to work with bad guys because we need oil and things like that. In Skyfall, I think it is that has all these really interesting ideas and it never does anything with it. It's like you were saying about like the privatisation of national security and drones and all this sort of stuff and abandoning like you said in our podcast when we did Skyfall, it's literally the Bond series being put on trial in Skyfall. But they never really do anything interesting with the ideas. It's just a complete waste of potential every time. I'm just getting more and more disappointed with it every new film that comes out.
No, it would be great to see James Bond do something similar to Winter Soldier. And because he is the equivalent, you know, he is our all British hero, you know.
Yeah, he's Captain Britain.
Essentially he's Captain Britain.
But it doesn't have the same ring to it as James Bond.
But there is a Captain Britain, but no, I know what you mean. yeah, so it is a shame. But I mean, it was fine. I haven't really...
Yeah, don't get me wrong. I enjoyed it. I enjoyed watching it, and I'll watch it again quite happily. But I just have to make my peace with it. It's not the film I wanted it to be. And I've done that with the past three Bond films. I'll do it again with this one.
Well, I suppose that leads us rather neatly to something that, well, you know, franchises that we hold in great esteem, what we expect from those franchises, what we want from those franchises, and whether or not those franchises deliver. Leads us rather neatly to Star Wars. But can I go and get another beer before we actually start? Because I think I'm going to need one.
Okay.
I will be back in just a second. In case you drink that, go with everything. Come and get it. They are hot, hot. They are Star Wars. The Force Awakens. Star Wars. The most anticipated film of the whole year. And I'm sure the most anticipated of our discussions for this episode.
It's hands down my favourite film of the year. Like, I fucking loved it. I'm just going to put that out there. I fucking loved it.
And I'm glad you did. And this is the thing, because there's been a lot of articles, a lot of kind of, you know, the way the internet is now, where there's a lot of articles that are just, like, needlessly being contrary. just to drum up some clicks and some views and all that kind of thing, and just to piss people off. You know, that's the way you sell a website now, is you just you just be a total...
yeah, clickbaity titles. Dick.
And, you know, I have enjoyed kind of needling Star Wars fans a little bit. But at the end of the day, you know, if Star Wars fans enjoyed it, then who am I to disagree? I'm Nakan. I'm just a guy with a podcast. I mean, the thing is, right, I went to see it because I wasn't going to see it in the opening day. I was like, no, I'll let it die down a bit, blah, blah, blah. And then I got caught up in the hype. Like, the week before, you know, there was, like, lots of interviews with people and there was, like, the premiere. And I was like, oh, actually, I'm kind of excited about this. It's kind of crept up on me. But, like, yeah, I'm quite looking forward to Star Wars. So I booked myself a ticket. We go and see it after work on the day it came out. Went along. And the thing is, the prequels, right? Love them or loathe them, most people loathe them. But do you know just one of the great things, even about the prequels, is that you get to hear that theme tune on, like, a cinema sound system. And it just does something to you. There's just this kind of really wonderful effect that John Williams' Star Wars theme tune has that you're just like, oh, there's just, like, tingles. It just sends tingles down your spine. And I had that, and I was like, oh, yeah, like, okay, I'm into this. And it opens, it's a really great opening, and I was swept along with it for the most part. Somebody asked me what I thought of it, and I said, cynical's the wrong word, because it's absolutely not cynical. But it does feel like a very meticulously put together exercise in reminding the audience of everything they love about Star Wars, the original Star Wars. And I understand why that is, especially after the prequels, which, you know, were not Star Wars. Yeah. That's just what they were, not that. And I caught a bit of... I was in HMV doing some Christmas shopping last month. And they had The Phantom Menace up on their sort of little Blu-ray demonstration, although everybody knows what a fucking Blu-ray looks like now, but they've still got it up. And they had The Phantom Menace on, and I stood watching a bit of it, and I was like, it's a cartoon. Like, none of it's real. It's just Ewan McGregor and Liam Neeson are just surrounded by green screen.
Phantom Menace is the only one of the prequels that has quite a bit of location shooting on it. Like, the rest of them are even worse.
There was a point quite early on in The Force Awakens where I was just like, no, this is the Star Wars that I remember really enjoying as a kid. So, okay, we're in safe hands here. This is going to be good. And for the most part, it is. I had a lot of fun with it. But there's just various moments in which the structure of it and certain things that... I say certain things that happen. I think, you know, we're going to... As we've always done with this podcast, we're going to talk about it in detail. So there will be spoilers.
Yeah.
And also, I think it's going to be quite cathartic for both of us to be able to openly discuss Star Wars. Because it's been a bit like living in a police state, you know, recently, where people are like, oh, I've not seen Star Wars yet, you can't talk about it, I don't want to hear what happens, and you're kind of talking in hushed tones.
Don't want to spoil it for the guy on the bus that I'm going, do you believe it, when and they're like, well done.
I think the moment the veneer kind of wore off a little bit was when they killed Han Solo. And I was like, okay, I see what's happening here. Because Han Solo, in terms of the character in this, he's Han Solo, as we know and love him. And isn't it lovely, isn't it really, really lovely to see Harrison Ford give a shit again and inject his performance with such charm and wit?
I wasn't sure it was identity again.
Right, exactly. It's but it's there and really refreshing to see. And that was great. But presumably he was doing that because he's like, well, this is the last time I'm going to play this character, so I might as well give it my all. So when they killed him off, I was like, okay, so he's the Obi-Wan Kenobi figure, as well as the Han Solo figure. Fine, and all of this, you know, it's like, and there's like lines in it where it's just like, oh, they built another Death Star. It's like, no, it's bigger than a Death Star. It's like, all right, okay. It's like that Jurassic World thing. You know, it's like, oh, we've built a bigger, scarier dinosaur. We built a bigger, scarier Death Star. It's the size of a planet. All right, fine.
Yeah.
And it was, from then on, just all these, just everything kind of just started to fall apart for me. I was just like, oh no, I was really enjoying this. And now the ruse is up. I see what they've been doing to me this whole time. Is that it's just a cover version of A New Hope.
See, this is my issue. Because a lot of people, the film's not perfect, but a lot of the criticisms I've been hearing, I just think are not quite really justified. Like, oh, it's just A New Hope 2.0 or whatever. And I think, yeah, I absolutely agree that I really wish or hope that, you know, the sequels, they come up with stories that aren't just being like Death Star blows up planet, basically.
And actually, to be fair, I think the way they've positioned these new characters, I do have faith that they are going to go off in a different direction now that they've established it's Star Wars again.
But yeah, I mean, that was... Because Return of the Jedi did it, this was just another... It was too much. You need to come up with something else. But a lot of the... I mean, that's the only thing that I found a bit too familiar. I know there's... A lot of people say there's other stuff that's a bit too familiar. Like, oh, it's set on a kind of... Tatooine type planet, and is they hide information in a droid. But if you watch the, I mean, yeah, it's set on a desert planet. But do you know why? Because they film stuff on location, and there are certain places on the planet Earth that you can go that you could maybe get away with looking like another planet. Desert, ice place, and the forest, maybe. So, you know, be grateful that they fucking shot things on a location, is my response to that. Hiding the information in a droid, yeah, it is kind of the same, but it's also very different, because R2-D2 holding that, you know, plans of the Death Star, it's not the driving force of A New Hope. They end up on the Death Star, and they have to try and escape the Death Star. You know, R2-D2 just basically sits in a room the whole time he's there. Getting that droid in Force Awakens, getting that droid and constantly rescuing that droid and who has control of the map is a big driving force of, like, momentum is what's, you know, moving the plot. It's just a lot more of the focus of the film than R2-D2 is at all. Like, once R2-D2 finds Luke Skywalker, it's just about the characters and what they get up to. It's not like this driving... So, yeah, it is the same, but it feels really different for me. And that's the whole thing. Like, I'm aware that there's similarities, but it never felt derivative to me.
Okay.
There's very obvious bits that, like, Abrams wanted to do his own version of, you know, like, he wanted to do his own sort of Mos Eisley Cantina with all the crazy alien creatures and the music in the background. He wanted to do his own kind of, like, Death Star Trench Run type thing. Without doing it the same or ripping it off, he wanted to do his own kind of version of it. And I'm okay with that, because it felt familiar. It felt like Star Wars without... Like I say, it never felt...
But that's what innovative. I'm saying, is that's what it's about. It's about reminding people that it's Star Wars. And actually, the best defence I heard of The Force Awakens was from Ross, a guy I work with at the theatre. And he said to me, he goes, yeah, but the thing is, Star Wars has always traded off nostalgia. You know, the original Star Wars films were nostalgia for those Flash Gordon serials. And I was like, yeah, you've raised a very good fucking point. And I'd never really thought about it that
way.
Yeah,
that's the thing. It's like, I've heard people criticising this. Oh, it's really, really, really based on coincidence, this film. And I'm like, is it like more than A New Hope, where R2-D2 carrying the Death Star plans literally lands on the planet where Luke Skywalker is, gets captured by the Jawas, and gets sold to Luke Skywalker, the son of Darth Vader, who happens to know Obi-Wan. You could look at every Star Wars film where they land on a planet, he lands on Tatooine, land on Dagobah, and happens to find what they're looking for within 5 minutes. It's a fucking planet! Luke has no idea where Yoda would be, but lands on the planet and finds him within 5 minutes. If you're going to pick holes in it, the Star Wars, the original films, they are not perfect. But they've become deified and people don't criticise them. They're the original Star Wars films. And I feel like people are being unnecessarily harsh on this film. It isn't perfect in no way. But people are, oh, it's too derivative. But people are overlooking what I think are a lot of really unique, original ideas in it. The whole opening scene with stormtroopers slaughtering civilians and then having a stormtrooper who's kind of like showing stormtroopers that are human beings capable of remorse and conflict, having breaking out of a Star Destroyer in a TIE fighter has never been seen before, seeing all the downed crashed Star Destroyers and scavenging them for parts, that's really original. The monsters loose on Han's ship, the Empire sort of Nazi-esque rallies. These are all like things we haven't seen before, and I think it does a lot of interesting stuff with the series sort of conventions. Like Jason pointed out, it's really interesting to see a dark Jedi struggling to resist the light side of the Force rather than the other way around.
Interesting, but I just wish, I don't know, I like Adam Driver and other things, but I didn't really buy into him. He's just a bit weedy.
Yeah, I mean, I'll admit, like, he got a lot less interesting when he took his mask off. I was very, like, and when he took his mask off, I was like, oh, really? This looks like a weedy teenager. But then maybe that's kind of the point.
No, I think you're right. I think that might be the point. But I just think, I don't know, like, there's that thing now in Hollywood films is that, you know, you can't hire an actor to just be in a mask for the whole thing. You have to have them show their face at some point.
But this is I was very acutely aware that I was watching the first installment in a trilogy, because
which you never had with A New Hope. It was a really great standalone film that had other things you could resolve.
But it wasn't the first part of a trilogy. That's the thing that a lot of people forget, because there was absolutely no way of knowing Star Wars was going to be the hit that it was, because, you know, everyone, even the people making it, thought it was a joke. The crew, the cast are very open about how they thought the whole thing was a fucking joke. And it was amazing. It set the world on fire. So,
I think that's my problem as well, though, is that it loses that innocence. It loses that kind of, that thing that A New Hope has, of this kind of, it's just a really exciting adventure. This sort of thing of, you know, overthrowing an evil empire, destroying the weapon. And
it takes itself a lot more seriously, and it knows it's Star Wars, but
the thing. I don't see this capturing the imagination of a new audience.
I don't think it... Yeah, I don't necessarily think it's supposed to. I think it's supposed to...
Well, maybe not,
reignite a pre-existing audience's interest. I think it's supposed to make people go, shit, Star Wars can be good again. Star Wars can be fun again. But I think a lot of the criticisms people are levelling at it, like you said, oh, Han Solo's the Obi-Wan figure. But if in the next film, like, Leia is, like, really spurred by vengeance, and Kylo Ren maybe is, like, really conflicted with regret and remorse, and is, like, once you've seen the whole trilogy in context and seen the story, actually maybe The Force Awakens will start to feel a lot less derivative, because it's not doing the same things that the first film did. It depends what... Because Vader has felt no remorse about killing Obi-Wan, and Obi-Wan comes back and he's sort of... You know, but Han's not going to be coming back as a ghost, because he wasn't a Jedi.
No.
You could do really interesting things with the next story, and then suddenly I don't think Force Awakens, in hindsight, will seem as derivative as people make it out to be. Because I think it did. I think people are overlooking the really original, or not original, but, you know, like, unique ideas it was bringing to the series. Because it, like,
In Empire Strikes Back, you hear Yoda talk about how you get, you know, with the Force, you can see the future, you can see the past, and you see that visualized. I think it was fantastic to see. Is it Rey? Is that her name? Touch the lightsaber and then get all the visions of the past, of the future. I thought that was fantastic because we haven't seen that visualized before through the eyes of someone that's in tune with the Force. I thought that was good. And like I said, I think it's really interesting to see us subvert the sort of stormtrooper, the mindless sort of henchmen, just sort of actually see them take the helmet off and see the person underneath. It constantly sort of plays on the idea that women don't need rescuing and like, compared to how the original film is like, oh, Princess Leia is rescued.
That's what, like, can I talk about something? Because I don't want to be down on Star Wars, because I know a lot of people love it, and I know I'm usually the one that's trying to talk you down for being negative. Because there was a lot of stuff I really liked about it, and I kind of want to talk about that. And Rey, or Rye, I don't know how you...
I think it's Rye.
Seems to be different pronunciations. Really plays into that. Because what I absolutely loved was the fucking switcheroo the marketing campaign basically made. Like, every photo up until The Force Awakens comes out, you know, it's always John Boyega holding the lightsaber.
Oh, right, yeah.
You know, he was on the Graham Norton show, and it's like, oh, John, like, let's have a lightsaber fight. You know, you hold the lightsaber and all that kind of thing.
Yeah.
So, like, it's constantly playing up, like, the guy, he's going to be the new Jedi that's going to, you know, that's going to bring balance to the Force and all that kind of thing. And then all the way through it, she's the main character.
Yeah, yeah.
And I just loved that kind of bait and switch approach. And she's so great. Like, I mean, John Boyega's fucking brilliant as well.
Yeah, I thought he was the standout role. Really good.
He's
and at first
fantastic.
I was quite unsure of that character. I thought she was a bit stiff, her performance at the beginning, but actually I grew to quite like her.
But then you see why, because she's, because I suppose the implication is that she's Luke's daughter.
Yeah.
Right? That is the...
Well, that's what I came away thinking. That, and
you know, she's sitting there waiting for her family to return, so you can understand why she would be a bit stiff and a bit... And so, like, I really like that character, and I love her and John Boyega together. Daisy Ridley and John Boyega together, I think they're really great.
Yeah, I liked all
the
new
cast. They've got really good chemistry together. And Oscar Isaacs as well, who I've always been a big fan of, actually, since Inside Llewyn Davis. He's great in the short amount of time that he's in it. Those new characters are really great, and I really hope that with the next two films, they kind of come into their own a bit more, because, I mean, a lot of The Force Awakens is about handing the torch on.
I like that you've got these new characters, and it's kind of like, again, another thing I think people don't give credit for what The Force Awakens did differently is that you've got, in Star Wars, the original film, kind of purpose is thrust upon Luke. Like, his parents, or his auntie and uncle were killed, and Obi-Wan's like, take up the Force, and he's like, yeah, he really doesn't have much choice. So he's like, this purpose in life finds him. But you've got two characters in The Force Awakens who are searching for purpose, and when they find each other, they kind of go on this journey together, and it takes them in different directions at times. You've got like where like Rey wants to go and fight with the Resistance, and Finn just wants to escape the Empire. He just wants to leave that all behind, and it's kind of I like that. It's they've got good, interesting character arcs to go on, and I think that's just really cool. I really liked that. It was doing something a bit different. It wasn't just the same. And I know there were lots of references to the original trilogy, but I don't know, every new thing it was doing, I was picking up on. I was like, this is different. This feels new. And for me, I know a lot of people, I can't just go, oh, everyone's talking bollocks, because I've met so many people that have said, yeah, it felt a bit like The Force Awakens. So I can't say that they're all wrong. All I can say is that for me, I was picking up on everything it did differently, and I didn't have a problem with any of the sort of familiarity that it had. I liked the references. I liked when Chewbacca, when I think Finn sits down and activates the chessboard, and Chewbacca's like, oh.
Yeah.
I liked that. It made me laugh. I thought, that's funny. Because it's like, yeah, the film knows. You haven't had a Star Wars film in over 30 years. You haven't. And it knows it. It almost disregards the prequel trilogy in a way. It doesn't... just the way it talks about the Force, the way it deals with certain, you know, like the stormtrooper takes his helmet off. He's not a fucking clone. He's a normal guy. I'd be all for Disney doing their own prequel trilogy and just retconning it, just saying it didn't happen. I know they won't, But I would fucking.
Well, they're
love
doing spin-offs
do
and stuff. So
yeah,
well, they're doing Rogue One. They're doing the Han Solo film. So they're kind of doing kind of prequels.
They shouldn't do a Han Solo film. That's just stupid.
But it's happening.
It shouldn't, because Han Solo, they got the same actor to play him as an old man as played him as a young man. Are they going to get fucking Bradley Cooper to play Han Solo? But it's not Han Solo, because Harrison Ford is fucking Han Solo. Oh, that upsets me. But going off on a tangent.
But the thing is, I mean, it's funny, because like, I came out of it feeling a bit, not cold, but I kind of had mixed feelings about it. And actually, just talking to you about it now, I'm like, I kind of want to go and watch it again.
I came out overjoyed, like genuinely filled with happiness. I was smiling. I was in a good mood for the rest of the day. It had such an overwhelming impact on my mood.
And we all know how rare that is.
I wanted to stand, at the end of the film, I wanted to stand up in the cinema and be like, it was good! Expecting everyone to go, I know, yeah! Like, it was fun. That's
what
I wanted.
Oh, God, that just reminded me of something. Have I told you my Han Solo death story?
No, I don't think
so.
So,
right, I'm sitting watching this in the cinema, and the scene in which Han Solo is killed and then thrown down, the best thing... one of the guys I work with is a huge Harrison Ford fan, and he said to me, like, the last time I saw him before my birthday, he says, because he's recently turned 30 as well, and he was like, good luck turning 30, because, you know, at least for me, you know, Han Solo was still alive, because like you're now turning 30, you're older, Han Solo's dead, that's a terrible thing to deal with. So, but when Han Solo died, and he falls down the pit, and the guy in front of me got up and left.
Really?
Like, after it happened. Fucking hell. And I was like, holy shit, is he that upset or annoyed? Eventually he came back, so I think he just maybe just gone, I really need a piss, but I think something really important's about to happen, so I'm going to have to just hold off. And then that happened. He goes, well, they're probably going to need a couple of minutes to decompress, so I'm going to go for a piss and I'll come back. But it was so funny just watching this guy get up and leave immediately after.
Like he was so emotionally invested. He's like, that's it. Nope. I'm out. Ruined it. Now, if I have any criticisms, I mean, there's a couple of things I had to criticise. I would say, again, like the Death Star sort of rehash thing, and Kylo Ren taking his mask off is kind of, but again, I wonder if in the context of the trilogy that will kind of be the point of it, because he did a teenager.
I think in the context of the fact that he's Han and Leia's son, and it, yeah, and you kind of need to have that kind of face-to-face confrontation
but
for Han's death to work
the
on
other
an
thing
emotional
is,
level.
I saw Han's death coming a fucking mile off. Like, I suspect, I mean, I know not too many people I've spoken to have reiterated this, so maybe it was just me being quiet. No. Fair enough. Because I watched the trailer, and knowing Harrison Ford thought he should have died in Empire Strikes Back, knowing that knowing Harrison Ford, he doesn't want to do it. He doesn't do anything unless they pay him enough. He just doesn't want to do films anymore. So I watched the trailer, and there's just one shot in the trailer where Leia's sort of hugging him, and I thought, well, that shot's in there for a purpose. You don't put that shot in there unless Han's going to die. And I just suspected he was going to die. And then when it reveals that Kylo Ren is their son, which I didn't see coming, I was sitting there, for some reason I was going, whose son's he going to be? Because I don't know anything about the expanded universe. I don't know if some people might have seen it or known about it just because of the expanded universe, the books and that. But I was like, whose son could he be? I was trying to think of all minor characters.
Well,
it hadn't occurred to me that it would be Han and Leia's son. But as soon as he said it was Han and Leia's son, and he was going, "Oh, there's something I need to do, but I'm struggling." I was like, "He's going to kill Han Solo. He needs to kill his parents. That's the thing he needs to do." And I just, as soon as he's going on that bridge, he's like, "He's absolutely, definitely going to die." It wasn't a surprise at all. I was by that point. I was like, gradually got more and more sure it was going to happen as the film went on. And by when he was stepping on that bridge, some people I've met said, I had no idea. I thought he was going to...
Oh, really? When he's stepping on the bridge, it's the most obvious it's ever been.
Yeah, but some people I've met thought, no, I thought he was going to, like, change Kylo's mind and, like, sort of, like, make him realise that... And I knew without a shadow of a doubt that I was going to get killed on that bridge. But, you know, I didn't have a problem with it. It was just, I felt like I missed out on something that a lot of people were really sort of surprised and shocked about.
Yeah.
And the only other criticism is I think it lacks any really memorable action
set pieces. Like even the Phantom Menace had like the pod racing sequence and the lightsaber duel.
I mean, the lightsaber fight at the end's quite, in terms of the sort of snowy forest and all that kind of thing, it's very well done. I don't know if it's.
I think it's more. This is the thing. I think all the action sequences, and this is weird, like, to think it's a criticism, but it's they're maybe too focused on character. Every action sequence is actually quite about what's going on with the characters, which is a good thing.
Mm.
But in a Hollywood blockbuster, you need to find that balance, and you need some mindless action. And I don't know that there's that much. I mean, you do have the odd action sequence, but they don't go on long enough, or not enough stuff. They're not big enough or grand enough, like, to be really memorable. And yeah, there's not that much in the way of really memorable action. Because that lightsaber duel, I love that lightsaber duel, because that's what a good lightsaber fight should be about. It's about the characters, and their fight is an expression of their internal struggle. Do you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And that's what makes it good. I'm glad that it isn't really flashy and showy like the Phantom Menace lightsaber duel, but in terms of action, you know, it's not that memorable. So it's, you know, it's
I mean, there is some really good sort of visual set pieces. Like, I think the X-Wings coming over the river and all that kind of thing, that's really good. And like I say, that lightsaber battle, and also her dream sequence as well, which sort of takes her into that forest and all that kind of thing. There's some really great visual moments. And like I say, I mean, as many reservations I have about The Force Awakens, I do have the utmost faith that the next two films could be something really, really special. And it's going to build on these and take the story in like some interesting directions. And honest to God, I've got proper goosebumps, although it goes on slightly too long. But that bit at the end, where like she gets to the top of the mountain, and she's got the lightsaber.
It does go on too long.
It goes on far too long. It's like, look, for fuck's sake, would you just take the lightsaber out of her hands? Jesus, man! But when he takes the cowl off and it's fucking Luke Skywalker with a big Obi-Wan Kenobi beard, I was like, oh yeah, I'm really looking forward to the next one.
Yeah. I went in because I wonder if part of the reason people are a bit harsh on it is because the trailer is fucking perfect. It makes best trailers I've ever seen. Because I quite like movie trailers. They were kind of a good trailer is when you have this sort of synergy of music, image, and words.
Mm-hmm.
And like the Man of Steel trailer is a great example. It looks perfect, and then the actual film is shit. But the trailer is just brilliant. And The Force Awakens is one of the finest trailers I've ever seen. The way the music builds and builds and builds into this crescendo of just images and words. It's just phenomenal. Yeah. The more I watched it, the more excited and hyped I got for it. And it's a perfect trailer. I wonder if that is... Everyone went in, I expect a perfect film now.
Yeah.
But it's not a perfect film. But all I went in, it's just hoping it would be fun and feel like Star Wars. And it ticked both those boxes 100 times. 5 minutes in, like when, I can't remember his name. Poe
Dameron.
Yeah, when his character gets dragged. Well,
Poe Dameron is the character. He's not the name of the fucking actor.
Yeah, that guy. When he gets dragged in front of Kylo Ren, and he's like, who's going to speak first? I thought that was hilarious. And I was like, this is Star Wars. This is fun. And I was sold. I was instantly sold. And I felt like a weight was lifted off my shoulders. Because like this, it just felt like Star Wars.
Yeah.
I don't know. It was just a really overwhelming experience to see it in the cinema. I felt the whole thing from start to finish was fun. I was invested in it. Yeah, it wasn't perfect, but I didn't care. I didn't come out wanting to criticise it, or I didn't feel cynical. I just felt overjoyed that it was fun and I had a good time watching it. And Star Wars as a series was fun again. And I came out thinking, I don't know how anyone can defend the prequel trilogy after this. Like, after seeing that actually, yeah, Star Wars can still be fun. Contemporary Star Wars films can still have all the same characteristics and heart of the and spirit of the original films. They didn't need to be these fucking boring, soulless, lifeless fuck-ups that the prequel trilogies that had no decent, didn't have a decent plot, didn't have decent characters or story arcs, it didn't have good script, it didn't have good visuals or good, you know, like filmmaking. It was just nothing. They were the most shitty
shitty films.
Well, look, we can all move on now.
Well, yeah, well, it's the thing. Like, I wish Disney, I wish they'd do their own prequel trilogy, because after seeing The Force Awakens, I'm sold. I think anything they do with Star Wars is going to be better than the prequel trilogies. And I'm confident as well that at least the second film, the next film, Episode 8, is going to be good, because I watched Looper again.
Oh, of course, yes. They've got that same... Isn't it?
At first, I was like, oh, Rian Johnson, because he does really specific... sort of like, I've seen Brick, which I didn't really like, yeah. And Looper, which I really liked.
But it's Breaking Bad like, episodes, although not really a good indicator of how good Star Wars is going to be.
I didn't actually like that Breaking Bad episode that
he's
much.
He's done more than that but the Fly one.
Is he? But I thought he does really like genre-specific films. But then I watched Looper and was like, do you know what? It's got good scripts, it's got good characters. It understands the importance of good scripts and characters. It's got a decent plot, but most importantly, it's like a really good blend of practical effects and special effects. And it uses CGI to enhance the story in the world rather than compensate for poor storytelling. So I thought, yeah, Episode 8 is in good hands. Episode 9 is...
Colin Trevorrow, who directed Jurassic World.
Yeah, so I'm very fucking worried about...
Have you seen the petition?
Episode 9.
Have you seen the petition?
No, is there a
petition? There's a petition to reinstate George Lucas as director of Episode 9 to bring the...
Are people mental? Yeah. Are people mental? Because it rhymes.
I mean, it's basically to kind of bring the Star Wars series full circle.
But there are prequel trilogy apologists out there. They're good films. There's a guy at work who was like, you're not slacking off the prequel films, are you? There's nothing wrong with him. I went, are you mental?
Yeah, because I mean, I read something recently. They were sort of saying that, everybody gives the Phantom Menace a hard time, but actually, you know, Attack of the Clones is really the worst one. And I kind of agree with that, to be honest. Because I remember watching Attack of the Clones and being like, oh, for fuck. Is this still going on? It's been hours.
Out of all the prequel trilogies, I'd probably rather watch Phantom Menace than any of them.
Yeah.
Because it looks nicer because it's shot on locations and sets.
Yeah.
And Darth Maul is a cool character.
Yeah, and that lightsaber battle, watch is, overblown and ridiculous as it is,
it's somehow absolutely horrendous, yet also quite good.
I think it's John Williams' score for it. I think that's what really
helps.
Things it. But anyway, that's not what we're talking about. but I mean. It's kind of nice that this year, in a kind of wrapping up of the year, that we've had Star Wars come back and it's not been shit. It's not been irredeemably shit. I had some problems with it, but by no means did I think it was a bad film.
Yeah. I haven't seen many. I think the films we've talked about this podcast are literally the only films from this year that I've seen. Apart from The Hunger Games, I don't think I've seen film. Force Awakens is hands down my favourite film of the year.
Well, my favourite film of the year is Inside Out. Which
none of the films we've talked about are even in your top 10,
no,
are they?
No, they're not. No, Mad Max is. Mad Max is number 8 in my top 10.
Oh, okay.
I think 2015 has been a great year for films. I don't know if it's just I've been seeking out films a lot more than I usually have or what, but it's just really felt like a really, really good year, and hopefully 2016 is going to be just the same. Who knows if we'll be when or if we'll be back. But it's been really lovely doing this again, man.
It has been fun.
It's been good.
I've enjoyed. I feel like I've been bottling up my thoughts on Spectre and Force Awakens for like ever since I watched them. I've just been bottling them up.
And hopefully, you know, the listeners at home have enjoyed this kind of. This two-part reunion special. I think the old format of doing like monthly releases probably won't work anymore. But if we can come up with a new variation, I'd be up for continuing.
Well, I'm a massive YouTube star now.
Well, that's true. That is true.
I was featured on Kotaku. I'm kind of a big deal. But I'd really like to do a YouTube channel.
Okay.
But
we'll soon be in the same country again. So
Yeah,
we'll see what happens.
We'll see what the future holds.
But yeah, been lovely to do this with you, my friends. Been lovely to hopefully entertain our listeners, and hopefully we'll speak to you all again soon. Happy
Thanks
New
for
Year!
Happy New Year!
3 weeks into it. Shall I stop recording? Did we say a proper goodbye there, or do you think we should do another one?
Bye.
Bye.